Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and they are back on point. Money ladies, hello, Michelle and Rana. Happy New Year.
Yeah, happy new year.
Happy New Year to you.
I am so happy to hear from you both. Okay, so, I guess I should give you your proper introductions. Oh my God, we've had you on so many times that people should just know that Michelle Singletary is a personal finance columnist for the Washington Post, nationally syndicated column, The Color of Money, author of a bunch of books as well. And Rana Fruhar is associate editor at the Financial Times, CNN's global economic analyst, also author of many terrific books. But really, for all out there listening, they are On Point's money ladies, okay? And, you know, I always want to welcome, you know, new people to our table. So I just want to give a 10-second recap about why you're the money ladies for the beginning of 2022. Because the first time we had you on, which was sometime in the beginning of the pandemic, right?
Yeah. It was maybe even before.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, my God. Wow. See, so what is time? It is a meaningless concept to me now. But, but after that first show, I mean, there was great conversation, fantastic analysis. There may or may not have been any tears, Michelle.
I'm guilty.
We got a flood of emails from people, including one from a gentleman who couldn't remember either of your names, but literally just said, bring back the money, ladies. So here they are. I want to know from both of you, first of all, Happy New Year. And do you have any New Year's resolutions?
This is Michelle. Yeah. I mine is always the same, is to lose more weight and exercise more. It's so funny. You know, I was pretty much the same weight most of my life, even through three pregnancies. And I hit this magic number, which I will not disclose. But I hit that number and it's like I eat a peanut and I gain 5 pounds.
Oh.
And so every year I'm trying to get back to that glory days. And so I try. Every year. Sometimes it works, sometimes not.
Well, it's Rana. I have a similar resolution. I'm actually having a dry January because, like many people in the pandemic, that one glass of red wine per night turned into two, sometimes two and a half, three. So, not only is that a weight issue, but I'm just thinking, you know, it's time to just look at the world from without the haze of red wine after 6 o'clock.
those are both really sound and smart resolutions. I mean, Michelle, mine's the same as yours for the following reason. I'm sort of like pathetically trying to grope towards normalcy in year two of this pandemic. And I thought, what could be more normal than making the same resolution I do every January and then not fulfilling it?
No, by March, you're like, whatever. Give me that bag of chips.
So it will set me right back to sort of a 2019 timeframe. But okay, so now that we got that out of the way, we're going to talk all things money for 2022. And it seems like the Fed essentially has given all Americans what they think should be a kind of New Year's resolution for folks, which is to pay down that debt for credit cards because interest rate hikes might be coming. Michelle, what do you think?
Definitely. I mean, they are trying to normalize the economy. You know, we've had these super, super low rates based on the Fed benchmark rate. And so people got used to really cheap debt. It meant people buying more, you know, spending up housing, you know, prices. And so now the Fed's saying, hey, listen, we need to do something about this to give us more in our wheelhouse if other things come down the road. And so they signal, you know, increases in their bench rate. So that will then impact consumer interest rates, mostly, I wouldn't say mostly, but credit card debt, because it's variable. So you've got a loan that has a variable rate, it's going to be impacted with the Fed rate increases. And so for me, that targets people who have a lot of credit card debt, and they're carrying it from month to month. And it's already been a burden, but now it's going to be, you know, even more so because you're going to have to pay more for that debt that you can't pay off every month.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so Ron, I'm going to ask you in a second about why the Fed's doing this, but just let's listen first to Fed Chair Jerome Powell, who says who said that they're going to ease up on asset purchases a little faster than expected.
Beginning in mid-January, we will reduce the monthly pace of our net asset purchases by $20 billion for Treasury securities and $10 billion for agency mortgage-backed securities. If the economy evolves broadly as expected, similar reductions in the pace of net asset purchases will likely be appropriate each month, implying that increases in our securities holdings would cease by mid-March, a few months sooner than we anticipated in early November. We are phasing out our purchases more rapidly because with elevated inflation pressures and a rapidly strengthening labor market, the economy no longer needs increasing amounts of policy support.
I would like to put that through the Rana Faruhar translation machine, please.
All right. In Fed speak, what that means is go way back to the great financial crisis in 2008. The entire economy collapses. We have the Great Recession. The Fed comes in as the buyer of last resort. They start buying up mortgage-backed securities. You know, those mortgage-backed securities were what blew up the financial system. So they're buying them up, kind of taking off, certain kinds of assets from the market, buying bonds, lowering interest rates, basically throwing a lot of easy money into the market with the idea of, increasing liquidity, keeping people purchasing things, keeping rates low so that debt that folks may have doesn't become too expensive, but also trying to push people in back into the market, you know, kind of keep the music playing. And, you know, that was necessary for a certain point. As you, Meghna, and Michelle will know, I thought that the Fed should have been paring back these purchases mm-hmm. long ago, but fast forward, 2019, 2020, you get the pandemic. The Fed continues its bond buying. Now, what happens? Well, part of the problem with all this easy money, even though it's necessary during times of crisis to sort of balm the pain that average people are feeling, it creates debt. It allows companies to take on a lot of debt at low rates. It bolsters the stock market, which, you know, many of us see this in our 401ks, to record prices, even as the story on Main Street is, you know, maybe not so secure. So you get that divergence, which actually increases inequality because people that are holding assets get a lot wealthier while people that are, you know, just getting a paycheck and not much else don't. You know. So you also get inflation. You get inflation eventually, and that's what we're seeing. So the Fed has finally decided, you know, they have a dual mandate. They have to both try to keep inflation under control and also keep employment as high as possible. Employment's pretty good. In fact, you know, it's tough finding workers these days, but inflation is getting out of control. So the Fed's saying, all right, it's time to, pull away some of that that money pot and slow the music, if not, you know, potentially stop the music at some point. The issue is whenever you do this, you get bumps in the market. Right. So we're looking at a pretty volatile 2020, which we can get into more if you like.
2022.
I promise I'm still doing dry January.
We're gonna talk about inflation here in just a second. But Michelle, let me turn back to you because really, Rana's right. Every time she's come on the show, and you've all written about this, both of you have written about this quite extensively, about sort of that Fed-juiced easy money that really was one of the things that helped power the stock market. We're going to ask about 401ks a little bit later. Worsened inequality, as Rana said. But now that the Fed is thinking about paring down, its purchases to control inflation, meaning in also then interest rates might go up. I guess what I'm trying to say is no matter what the Fed does, is it the average American that kind of gets the short end of the stick here?
I think for a great deal of Americans who are struggling, yes. And it's always, you know, it's been that way for quite some time. The pandemic just sort of ripped off that Band-Aid and just showed this sore that still wasn't healing. And so it's really, I mean, Ron, we've talked about this quite a bit, the has and the have-nots. And Ron just talked about that. Those who have money in the market, their 401k, they're investing, you know, they've got to sell a house. They did fantastic over the last 2 years. Why so many people are struggling, losing their job, not sure how to keep a roof over their heads. So when, you know, inflation takes up, now people who had took on a lot of debt, you know, maybe they got an arm for their mortgage to kind of maybe afford that house more. Now, if, you know, if that arm is going to be readjusting, it's not, it's out of that introductory period where it stays the same, mm-hmm. then they're going to see increases in that. If you borrowed on your home for the home equity line of credit, you're going to see, you know, that variable rate going up. And so people who were living on debt and basically increasing their lifestyle on their debt are going to feel that pain. Those who were already struggling, the, you know, it's like they're like throwing their hands up, like, what else can you do to me? I'm right. really still suffering.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then savers who've been waiting actually for, you know, the Fed rate to go up thinking, yeah, I'm going to get more of that money in my savings account. Probably not. It's going to maybe, you know, you'll get two more dollars this year than you did last year for that money. So while, and that's why I sort of try to encourage people that you do need to invest and figure out some ways to grow that savings. You just can't keep it in a bank account. That's not going to do it for you. That's not going to get you where you need to be for retirement.
Yeah. Well, Rana, we've just got a minute before the first break here. Same question to you, because, you know, we can talk about how the market's going to behave. We can talk about, you know, the Fed's balance sheet, et cetera. We will talk about inflation. But overall, I mean, what do you think the picture is for average Americans? Savers might get a bit more, but like for people who've got 401ks, maybe they're worried about a correction. I don't know.
You know, this actually, I don't know if I can answer this in a minute, but I had a conversation recently with Heather Boucher, who's on the council, the president's economic advisory council. And she made an interesting point. She said, you know, we used to look at GDP as a measure, you know, the rate of growth in the economy, which is, you know, usually about 3% on trend in the U.S. It's been lower and higher in recent years, but as a measure of how everyone was doing. But from the late 70s onward, that started to diverge. So we have a lot of different economies in America now. We don't just have a 3% economy. We have a 6% economy. We have a 1% economy. Yep. You know, I think that depending on where you live, you're going to feel all these different dynamics of asset price inflation, wage inflation, very differently in the coming year.
Okay. Well, we have Rana Faruhar and Michelle Singletary with us. They are On Point's money ladies. Go to Facebook or Twitter at On Point Radio and ask your question about your financial future for 2022. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And today, Michelle Singletary is with us. She's the personal finance columnist for The Washington Post, nationally syndicated, and also author of the 21-Day Financial Fast. Rana Faruhar is with us as well, CNN's global analyst, Financial Times associate editor, author of Don't Be Evil and Makers and Takers. And collectively, these two fabulous women are the On Point money ladies. I feel like we need a cheer or a walk-on song. I'll just nod to Beyonce and be like, always be gracious because the best revenge is your paper. All right. But we've got some questions that have come immediately right in, and then we're going to talk a lot about inflation. Actually, this first question is from Jocelyn Johnson, who is wondering if she will be able to purchase an affordable used car this year. Michelle, what do you think?
It's going to be very difficult. The price of used cars, it's in the 20 to 30% range in terms of price increases. You know, I had a friend who were buying a car for trying to buy a used car for their daughter. By the time they had worked it out, got to the lot, it had been sold, and they actually bought a new car that was only $2,000 more than the used that they were trying to buy. So it's going to be very difficult. You're going to have to look, be prepared to not, you know, oh, I'll come back later and see about it. No, if you see it and it's a good price, grab it then. So it is going to be difficult. So my solution to that is to just broaden your range, you know, in terms of the type of car, maybe go back another year. You know, you were going to maybe buy one for 2018, maybe buy one for 2017. You're going to have to be very flexible in substituting the things that you want, not just in used cars, but any other goods as well. If prices are increasing in the area where you want to buy something.
Right. So Rana, do you see these pressures on these kinds of goods going down or at least stabilizing over the next year? Or the combination of the economy and supply chain issues just going to be dogging all of us for all this year?
So I don't think that you're going to see, you know, a real wholesale decline in inflation, but I think you're going to see some volatility. And I'll tell you why. There's sort of two or three key factors pushing inflation, and there's one deflationary factor. Let me explain. Supply chain issues. I mean, we've all heard about these by now. The big delays at ports in LA, the fact that, you know, in the midst of the pandemic, you had most of the masks coming in from China. Suddenly, China wants to keep all its masks. You know, you can't get things here, and so on and so forth. And so all of that has combined to create a situation in which over 90% of companies in a recent McKinsey study are saying, you know what, we want to change our supply chains. We want to do more locally and regionally. That's, you know, ultimately actually maybe a good thing for jobs, but it's going to increase some inflation in the short term. Those bottlenecks are going to take a while to work out. At the same time, you have rising wages. Again, that's, you know, kind of good for a lot of people to, you know, it's about time we all had a pay raise, but it's harder for companies, makes it tougher for them to keep prices down. So all this is part of this really major transition in our economy that is going to take 3 years, 5 years, 10 years to work itself out. Now, there's one big deflationary factor, though, which is technology. Think about, for example, what happened at restaurants during the pandemic. You know, I was traveling, you know, even during the pandemic to a certain extent, and you started to see in airports, you know, there were no more servers. Yeah. There were these sort of kiosks. You know, that's just one tiny example.
I thought you were going to mention the menu QR codes, which I hate.
Well, yeah, and those aren't going away, P.S. You're going to just have to get used to them. But there's all kinds of things like this. I mean, we have automated ships that are going to be taking off this year from Norway to ship goods with you know, there's no captain on board. I mean, they're just automated ships. All this stuff is happening across a really broad swath of business. That is deflationary. It's going to bring prices down. But this is a complex picture. I mean, we are going through kind of a once-in-a-lifetime shift, and it's not going to, you know, be over this year.
Okay, Michelle, I'm going to come back to you in a second. But Rana, just very briefly, are you team not transitory then for inflation?
I'm team volatile. I think it's going to be up and down, and it's not going to be one number. It's going to be across different types of goods, different dynamics. It's going to just like, you know, we have many economies. There's one economy in Palo Alto and there's another in Detroit. You know, you're going to see really different inflation dynamics in different goods depending on where you live.
Okay, because Michelle, everyone wants to know if this is going to be transitory or not.
Yeah, you know, and one the two big questions, or should there actually a lot of them, but you know, what should I do about my you know, retirement account and investment? Should I move in the market, move out, be more conservative? I also get a lot of questions about, is it now time to buy a house? Should I wait? And I think Rana is right. You have to judge it based on where you are, your financial situation, and what makes sense for you. Like, people are losing their minds trying to buy a house now. Well, maybe it's not time for you. You don't want to overextend yourself trying to grab a house thinking it's not going to be there. They're going to be houses, y'all, next year and the year after that. So just take a pause. But it's hard because people are worried about, you know, how to handle their money. My husband and I, you know, every quarter we start to try to do our finances and look at it. And at the beginning of the year, we look at what we're putting in our retirement account. And I spent, like, yesterday just it was maddening thinking about all the things that we have to do to make sure our money is right. So I get why people are so confused. But my advice to people for 2022, with all of these things on the plate and the volatility of that's going to happen, is to just sit down, plan, and do what makes sense for you, and don't overextend yourself.
Can I just add something on housing, Meghna?
Yeah.
I do think that we're going to see something of a housing correction. I mean, there's a fascinating new geography of work and life that is taking place. I think we've touched on this a couple times. Post-pandemic, people really can live in a whole new variety of places. A lot of companies are not going back to 5 days a week. You're seeing 2-3 hours outside of cities. You're seeing huge price increases. Now, I think some of those markets are going to correct. This typically happens when there is an overheated housing market, which I do believe we have right now, and then you get a correction. The prime areas may correct, you know, the Gold Coast places, the places where there was always a lot of money may correct 5 or 10%, but you may see some of those, you know, edgy 2 hours, 3 hours outside the city, you know, where you're suddenly paying double what you might have for a house 3 years ago. Those places are going to correct. So I would wait for some of those rate hikes. If I were buying a house outside a prime market, I'd wait and see how those rate hikes affect prices going forward.
Okay. So kind of a pause and observe. But Michelle, yeah. I mean, I think Patricia Roberts has a specific question about refiing her mortgage. Is there any reason not to refi right now if we're talking about a period of upcoming volatility?
So again, it's an individual situation. So, you know, people just look at the interest rate, but there's more involved in that. If you're, say, you've got a 30-year mortgage and you're, you know, 20 years in, you don't want to reset that mortgage even at a lower rate,
yeah.
You know, but if you've only been in the house for a couple of years and maybe you're thinking, well, this is not my last house, I'm going to move. And it makes sense if you got a higher interest rate than to refinance, you've got to do the math. In fact, you know, I just recast my mortgage, which is something that people don't really know about. So I, you know, had a bond fund that was paying nothing. And it was, you know, some money sitting aside. And my husband and I said, you know, we are on a mission to pay off our mortgage before we retire. And so we had a lump sum of money sitting in a bond fund paying nothing. Mm. And so I called my mortgage and I was thinking about just putting it on the principal. And then I did some research and found recasting. So I took that lump sum, recast my mortgage, which basically means they rewrote the mortgage. The interest stayed the same. I've got a 2.75 interest rate. We had a 15. We've been paying it off. So we got it down to like almost 8 years and things like that. And so now my mortgage payment went down significantly by just recasting it. I didn't refinance. It didn't cost me a dime to recast. Not all mortgages are available for this, but it happened to be with my lender. It was. It didn't cost me anything. I save hundreds of dollars on my mortgage every month. So that's why I'm saying you've got to do some research and see individually. But I would say that if it makes sense for you to refinance, yes, refinance as soon as possible before the rates go up.
Okay, Michelle, you're I consider myself like semi-decently informed about financial matters, but I am going to admit, I don't, recasting a mortgage? This is the first time I've heard of it. Anything?
I know,
what is that?
Right?
But what is it?
So you know, you have an amortization schedule for your mortgage.
Yeah.
And you say 30 years, 15, and it says you got to make this payment for these amount of years at this interest rate. If you have a lump sum of money, you can then, they basically rewrite your mortgage. So let's say you've got a $200,000 mortgage and you've got $20,000 or $30,000 in, you know, a bond fund, something, you know, got inheritance. You can take that $20,000 or $30,000, put it on that mortgage. So you're bringing it down to like $180,000. They will recast your mortgage to the $180,000. And then you're saving. Now, the key is because we make extra principal payments. So now we're going to continue to make those, even though everything stays the same. So wherever you're in your mortgage, it stays the same. And the interest rate stays the same. But because the mortgage is less, we're paying less in interest, and more of our money goes to the principal.
Uh-huh.
So we pay it off sooner and with less interest.
This
is always
mind blown.
I know, right? It blew my mind. And I didn't even know about this. And so we just recast it. And by February, we will. And so now what we're going to do is make the exact same mortgage payment so that we are going to get rid of our mortgage, hopefully this year or next year, by, you know, but all the things that we've done over the years. So that's what I'm saying. 1 year we did refinance, and then leading up to that, we didn't. We just made extra mortgage payments, principal payments, I mean. So that way, you know, so that's what I'm saying. Just don't get focused on the interest rate. Think outside the box and do some research. And you might do a combination of things. Refinance when it makes sense, or just make principal payments to reduce the time that you are making a mortgage payment. Now, I know there are financial people out there saying, well, you should put that money in the market because you're going to earn more, you know, and I'm thinking, well, you know what, when I retire, I ain't going to have no mortgage and you're going to still be paying the mortgage.
And the market might have corrected 40% by then, too. Who
knows? Exactly, exactly. But individual, to me, it makes sense. I don't want to carry debt into my retirement because, you know, that is the largest piece of your budget in retirement.
It's so interesting. I think there's a real gender divide here. Michelle, I'm completely on page with you, and getting rid of a mortgage is one of my goals as well. My husband, no, totally. Why are we not putting this in the stock market? I hear this from men and women a lot. There's a lot of differences in terms of how people think about money. It's fascinating.
I think, well, look, women are likely, statistically likely to live longer. And so you got to plan for a longer period in retirement, and having housing security at that time makes sense to me to be really, really important. Now, look, oh my God, all these inflation questions coming in now. So let's refocus back on the macro level, Rana, because Keith Allen Cooper says higher inflation seems to be caused by the pandemic. So if the pandemic subsides, inflation should also, right?
Yes and no. It's a very complicated dynamic. I mean, one of the, for me, kind of fascinating things, but also anxiety provoking for, you know, just as from an individual investment standpoint, is there's not one inflation dynamic right now. And that itself is a cause of the pandemic, or, you know, a result of the pandemic. The pandemic was not coordinated globally. You know, you remember it started in China. China locked down quickly, got back up and running quickly. By that point, Europe was having problems, then the US. And each separate wave has hit different regions at different times. That's created those strange bottlenecks in supply chains and mismatched recovery and recession cycles. That creates weird push-pulls that are, they're just very unusual and very different from what we had in the 70s, where you had kind of one big dynamic, stagflation, an energy shock. This time around, it's playing out in all different ways. And again, depending on where you live, depending on how you shop, I mean, you know, prices, for example, in standalone grocery stores have gone up much more than prices, you know, on FreshDirect or Amazon. You know, so if you're doing online shopping, which a lot of people in urban areas do, you might not be feeling that so much. If you're going to the grocery store, you probably are. Certainly, if you're gassing up a car, you are. So it's really varied. I don't think we're going to see an overall drop in consumer price inflation in 2022, but I think you'll see a slowdown in the growth of inflation. And I think that depending on where you live, you also may see some correction in housing, in food and energy, you know, at various points in the year.
Okay. So we've just got a couple more minutes before our next break here. But again, lots of questions coming in about how various corrections are going to have an effect on people's individual finances, because especially with that sort of Fed adjustment coming down the pike. Here's Karen from Des Moines, Iowa, and her question.
I am still working and paying into a 401k, but I waited all of 2021 for a correction in the Dow. I was expecting it to fall, but it didn't. We're still having record highs. So I will be due for my first mandatory distributions, not for another 5 years. But are there any alternatives to the stock market you might recommend as an investment, or should I just not worry about it and hope for the best?
Now, Michelle, we've gotten a lot of questions for people who are looking at retirement in the next, like, 2 to 5 years. They are concerned that those 401ks are going to shrink unless they do something.
Yeah, you know, here's where it's very difficult the closer you get to retirement and in the beginning years of retirement, because you don't, if you're not going to be working, this is all the money. And so obviously you're very concerned of it you know, the value going down. But you've got to think of retirement long term. I know it sounds crazy, right? But if you're retiring in your 60s, you still could live another 20 or 30 years. And so what you want to do is make sure you've got a cash cushion. So if you need money in the next 2 years of your retirement, you want to make sure that you can access the money you need for, you know, housing, food, and things like that, and not touch your retirement money if there is a correction, so that when the market stabilizes, you know, it'll go back up or some of those returns will come back. You won't be in a panic. And that's how my husband and I have been doing our retirement. We're getting closer to that point and looking at it, but we also are doing other things on the other side of that ledger. We're getting rid of our mortgage. We don't carry any consumer debt. We, you know, send our kids to college without any debt. We watch what we spend. And so all of that will contribute so that you don't panic and pull the money out, because you are going to need growth over those years if you're not putting new money into those investment accounts. And so, again, the thing is to have a financial plan. Stick to it. This is how I want to invest. This is how risky I want to be, how, you know, conservative I want to be. Set that plan. Outside of that plan, make sure you have, you know, I would say at least 2 to 3 years worth, not necessarily all in cash, but, you know, you might have some in some bonds and things like that. And then keep down your expenses, and you can weather these corrections, generally speaking.
Well, send more of your questions to On Point Radio at Facebook and Twitter, and Michelle Singletary and Rana Fruhar, our money ladies, will answer them. When we come back from the break, we're going to talk about how policy out of Washington is going to influence your financial future for 2022. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow on the show, we're going to be talking about how President Biden's Build Back Better proposal could have an impact on the lives of West Virginians. Of course, the senator from West Virginia, Joe Manchin, has the power to make or break a Biden administration plan on a social spending package. He doesn't seem to be very for it at the moment. But if you live in West Virginia, we really want to hear from you, from paid family or medical leave, the child tax credit, expanded child care. Could you or your family benefit from the policies in a social spending package like the one the Biden administration wants to advance? Or are you concerned about the cost of that package? How do you think about this? What actually would make your lives better? West Virginians, we want to know. Call us at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. That's for tomorrow's show. Now, speaking of Build Back Better, that's what I'm going to ask our money ladies, Rana Fruhar and Michelle Singletary, who are with us today, their thoughts about that. But let me tee up a couple of differing opinions about increased federal spending. Here's Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell back in November saying that the Biden administration is to blame for rising inflation.
This could not be a more challenging problem confronting America. And as we all now know, this was created by this administration by dumping almost $2 trillion on the economy through the American Rescue Plan, and even liberal economists who actually like what they're trying to pass now, the reckless tax and spending spree, admit that on this issue, it will only make it worse.
Senator McConnell in November, and here's President Joe Biden in December.
If you look at what's inflation all about for people, they're paying more for things they need than they had to pay before. That's the bottom line. Now, if they're paying considerably less for childcare, considerably less for health care, considerably less for insulin, considerably less, and go down the list of being able to take care of their parents, all the things that are in the Build Back Better plan. The reason why economists think it's going to, in fact, diminish the impact on inflation is because it's reducing cost for ordinary people.
Now, Rana, let me first turn to you here, because in those two clips, we heard basically polar opposite views on how to look at the impact of major legislation like Build Back Better. Yeah. And how do you look at it?
Well, it's about your time frame. You know, I mean, is it possible to look at infrastructure building and investment in childcare and investment in education and say this will cause a certain amount of inflation in the short term? Sure, it is. But it's sort of amazing to me. We've come for a half a century to what I think is the apex of a very dangerous place in our economy, where we have built an economy based on debt. We haven't invested in everything from our roads and bridges to our educational system to our children, which, you know, P.S., growth is basically population plus productivity. So if you're not, you know, encouraging families and birth rates and a healthy population and investing in them, not just, you know, where they live and how they live, but how they're educated, you don't have an economy. So that's what I think the Biden plan is all about. Now, I'm not going to say every part of Build Back Better is seamless and perfectly productive, but is it going to help us grow? And is it going to lower prices over years, not just months? Yes, it is. There is no question. I would challenge you to find any serious economist that would argue differently.
Well, Michelle, what do you think about that? Because, you know, the argument that Senator McConnell's making makes kind of intuitive sense. You pulse money into the economy, you get inflation, right? That's kind of an easy arithmetic for people to understand. But the point that both Rana and President Biden are making is there's sort of another half of the equation that we're not looking at, which is the cost right now that people are bearing to live, to survive. And if we can come up with systems to reduce that cost, perhaps the temporary increase in inflation isn't going to be as painful as people think it might be.
I agree. I agree with Biden. I agree with Ron. This Build Back Better wants to invest in making sure that people have a living wage, that they can afford to send their kids to college, that they don't have to worry about every month whether or not I can keep a roof over my head. And I've said this every time I come on the show, that when we help the least of these, we help each other. And just look at Social Security. One of the reasons why there is a problem with the funding of that is that there's not enough young people paying into it and workers. And so if people are not earning a good wage, you're not paying more into the system that is going to take care of McConnell and all them other people who think, you know, let's just pull yourselves up by your bootstrap kind of theory. People at that lower level, they're not asking for you to take care of them for the rest of their lives while they sit on the couch and watch television. They're saying, listen, I want to go to work, but I can't go to work if I can't afford to send my kid to daycare or aftercare. I want to go to work, and I will go to work if I can earn a living wage. And right now, during the pandemic, earn a living wage that isn't going to endanger my health and the health of the people in my household.
Yeah, by the way, there's no evidence. There is absolutely no evidence that any of the post-pandemic stimulus programs have created a disincentive for work. There just isn't.
Absolutely. It isn't. It's insane for them to say that. But again, think about the people who are making these policies. A lot of them come from money. They don't have to worry about none of those. They don't have to worry about their retirement. You know, they're going to be paid well when they retire, if they ever retire. They're not looking at it from those folks' point of view. It's looking at they're just takers. They're just takers. They just want a hand up. And we all may have to endure a little bit of pain, a little bit more inflation so that we all are lifted up. Yeah. And, you know, listen, I hate paying taxes like everybody else, but I don't go mad about it because I know that my taxes pay for the roads. I'm looking out my window. I've got all the snow and this a snow pile came through from the county and got the snow. And, you know, if we need to leave, we can leave. That costs money. I want to go across a bridge and make sure it's going to stand up. You know, we want to build a way for people to get to work, you know, better transportation so that maybe we don't have to all have cars getting to work. And you know, I saw something on Twitter. Someone said about what we're talking about, you know, is insignificant at the individual level if policy doesn't follow. But actually, it's got to be both personal responsibility and policy. Mm. Those two things together will build a better America.
That's right.
Rana, I mean,
well, you know, I just think it comes down to time frame. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's stunning to me how people think that, you know, there needs to be one silver bullet action that the administration should take that should fix everything. It took us 40, 50 years to get to this place where we have this level of inequality in this country, where we have a system that is this polarized, where we have, you know, a population that is kind of at war with itself. Mm-hmm. We're not going to get a fix from one thing. But I will be honest, I think that almost everything that this administration has done vectorally has been correct. Not that there aren't, you know, there's always some pork in this or that plan. But, you know, basically the administration is saying we have a problem that is going to be fixed over years, over decades, but we are going to lay down some foundational pillars, investment in hard infrastructure, investment in human capital, in people, in brain power. I mean, these are the things that other countries are doing. China's doing this, folks. This is our competition. If we're not going to do it, we're going to end up like Brazil. And, you know, people are going to, the rich are going to be flying from helicopter to helicopter on top of each other's buildings, and everybody else is going to be screwed.
there's a new dystopian view of the future.
But I'm just so sick of the short-termism. I honestly, like, I go on TV and I'm asked, you know, inflation, what's it up or down? I'm like, you might have to pay a little more in the next few years so we can make a generational transition in our economy, folks. Let's try and get behind something that's, you know, that takes more than 5 seconds and can't be encapsulated in 140 characters.
Okay. You know what? For people who are financially secure, I completely agree about the toxicity of the short-termism. But for people who are not financially secure, their whole lives are lived on the short term, though, right? Because, you know, they don't even know if they're going to have the same paycheck 2 weeks from now, let alone a month from now. Or we've all talked about how, you know, everyone feels, not everyone, but many people feel like they're one paycheck away from disaster or one hospital trip away from disaster. So I can actually sympathize with some short-termism for people who simply don't have the luxury of doing things on the long term. So Michelle,
go ahead.
I was just going to turn this back to Michelle here for a second. And then Ron, I'd love to hear you on this too. But I'm sure you get letters or interact with people who fall into this category, who say, you know, sure, I would love for Washington to pass some stuff. Maybe that might help me with childcare. But right now, this 5% inflation, like, I can't pay my gas bill. So, like, how do you balance those two things?
Yeah, you know, it's really difficult for me because I operate in both worlds, you know, writing about policy and personal finance in a really personal level. And which is why I always tear up, right? Because I actually am dealing with these people, looking at their budgets and thinking, I don't know how you're going to make it either. And then trying to look at them and give them a solution. So this is what I say on a very personal level, if you're struggling, that you've got to take a step back. And even though you may have to think out of the box. And I say it to people, you know, like housing. You might have to live with someone or bring someone into your house. You team up with another single parent. You know, go back and live with your relatives. I was just talking to my nephew who's taking on a whole bunch of debt to be a physical therapist. And he's such a great kid. And I said, listen, when you finish, go live with your mama for 3 years, take all your salary, pay off that debt, you'll be done in 3 years. And he's looking at me like, are you serious? I'm like, honey, that's just a blip in your life. And so that's how I deal with people on a direct basis. I try to look at what they have and what is possible for them where they are. And that also means being a little harder on some people. No, you can't go to that college and live on campus. You got to stay at home with your mama. Yes, you do have to go live with your parents. Yes, a couple with a kid, go live in somebody else's basement for a year or two. And people look at me, well, how can you tell them that? What are you going to tell them until policy catches up with reality? You know, so I try to tell people, do stuff hard. And even if you're struggling, you've got to think long term still. And you pull yourself together. I have always had someone live in my house. My sister lived with me for 3 or 4 years. Her kid lived with me. I had another relative live with me. And that's how you answer it on a personal level. If you're struggling to figure out how you're going to retire, then you got to think about a different retirement. Maybe you can't retire. We just had the post. We just looked at how many people quit their jobs. And some people are saying, I'm done, I'm ready. But maybe you're not done and ready, because if the money isn't there or you can't sustain yourself, you got to stick it in there for a little bit longer to create some security for yourself. If you're living in a big place and you've got a nephew or a niece or a friend or somebody, you know, open your door and help them live for a while. That's what I tell people,
you know,
because that's all I got for them right now.
Yeah,
until policy catches up.
Michelle, you know, if we were sitting across the same table, I would be giving you a hug right now, because I completely hear you about people having to do something that's a little bit hard. But listen, there is a lot of, you know, better than anyone, frustration out there because people feel like, you know, there's a narrow band of this country that actually has all the wealth that isn't doing anything hard, right? I mean, So, Rhonda, let me turn to you on that because, I mean, we are all in this together. And I do wonder, like, what will it take to, you know, send the same message to people who can afford it a little more, because they're earning 6, 7, 8, nine figures, you know?
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm gonna shift gears a little bit. I mean, I agree with Michelle. I think there are creative solutions. It's kind of fascinating. The co-housing trend, I think, is big, not just amongst young people. My daughter is going to be living with many people when she graduates, but also intergenerationally and amongst older people. I think that's going to become a big trend. I also think policy-wise, you know, the Biden administration can and should be trying to salvage some of Build Back Better by saying, all right, you know, if we can't keep the child care subsidy for everybody, let's keep it for those at the bottom 25% that really need it the most. Mm-hmm. But you said what could bring the country together. I have an idea, a year of service. I think, you know, I look around, there are countries, Israel would be one example, where rich or poor, you have to do a year of service. Now, in that case, it's military. It wouldn't have to be. You could do something around education. You could do something around elder care, around child care. But I think we need something in this country that you cannot buy your way into or out of, that everybody has to do together in order to get some cross-pollinization between different groups, geographically, politically. You know, we need some kind of sense of shared commitment and sacrifice in this country. And so that's something I've been thinking about as a possible solution.
Michelle, I love that idea. Love that idea. I think that that is the key to why there's not enough compassion, because you haven't walked in either alongside or somebody else's shoe. I love that. I have lived my life on service. I was rescued by my grandmother. I was rescued by other people who took interest in my life. And so I have volunteered every year of my life since I can remember, from age like 14 and 15. I used to take my dog to nursing homes to visit, you know, patients, you know, when I was in my early 20s, because I just knew what it was like to be abandoned and be someplace and not really have, you know, people care about you. And I think that's a wonderful idea economically. And, you know, if that means that you know, the year of service, but also just sort of thinking, you know, we've got these little stockpiles of money, and it's like, this is my pile, and you need to get your pile, and, you know, and I, you know, don't touch my pile. Well, you know what? We might need to touch your pile a little bit to help somebody else. and maybe that means you take one less vacation, or, you know, I mean, come on, guys. You know, this country could be so much better if we thought about our fellow man, which is what Rana was talking about.
Yeah, maybe own one less helicopter, right? So
I would say something else, but I don't want to lose my job.
Michelle Singletary from The Washington Post and author of The 21-Day Financial Fast. Michelle, Happy New Year to you, and thank you as always.
Thank you so much. Happy New Year to you as well.
And Rana Faruhar, CNN Global Analyst, Associate Editor at The Financial Times, author of Don't Be Evil, Makers and Takers. Happy New Year to you as well, Rana.
Happy New Year, and here's to a better 2022.
This is On Point.